I would go way further than sobering. You know, I think there's an enormous sense of regret in corporate sustainability in New Zealand at the moment for those of us that have worked in it for a long time, because it's kind of like, you know, we saw this train coming down the tracks and we knew this was going to happen, and now it's happening.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Welcome. Today's guest is Jerry Ward, Director of Climate Change and Sustainability Services at EY New Zealand. EY being one of the big four global accounting firms. In this conversation, Jerry offers her perspectives on corporate sustainability in New Zealand and the region, and how do we close this value action gap? We talk about things like ESG, the Paris and Montreal agreements, biodiversity and carbon credits, and so much more. And we really go deep around climate-related financial disclosures. New Zealand was actually the first country in the world to mandate the financial sector report on climate-related risks. This was a law passed in 2020 that's just now taking effect. Jerry is on the front line in seeing how is this impacting conversations in the boardroom. And she closes this discussion with her advice for how businesses can drive more sustainability overall. All right, let's get into it. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jerry Ward. Today, we are here with Jerry Ward. Jerry is the Director of Climate Change and Sustainability Services at EY. Thank you, Jerry, for being here.
Kia ora, Matt. Nice to be here.
So maybe we start with your background. How did you come into this line of work and into this role at EY?
Sure. Well, I've been at EY working in sustainability and climate change for about 2.5 years. Prior to that, I was the head of sustainability and community at Z Energy, which was Shell before it was acquired several years ago. And before that, I worked in central government in New Zealand, first for the Ministry for the Environment, working on climate change and carbon neutrality, and then for the Department of Conservation, working on biodiversity offsetting. So I've been in the sustainability game for far too long now. Yeah.
And so what's been the driving motivation and, you know, the why behind your work?
The why behind my work, that's the question. Yeah, I mean, like everyone, I mean, I came to EY very deliberately a couple of years ago to have more of an impact across a greater number of businesses, you know, than one. I'd been at Z for about 8.5 years and absolutely loved it. Felt like I'd had the impact that I could have, and very deliberately chose, as most of people in my position do, and most of my colleagues at EY, to move into a role where it's the fastest growing business unit is the Climate Change and Sustainability Services team. Mm. So you're very consciously, deliberately having more of an impact across more businesses than you can elsewhere.
And so how would you frame kind of corporate sustainability more broadly here in New Zealand, and having worked in these different, whether it was Department of Conservation or Z Energy and now EY, like give us your bird's eye view into this space.
Yeah, I had a watershed moment last year where my brilliant colleague, Adam Carroll, who's one of the partners in the EY Perth team, authored a report called the Enough Report. And it's a review of corporate sustainability over the last sort of 30 years and kind of where we've gone wrong, I guess. And the thesis behind it is, or the hypothesis behind it is, that when corporate sustainability as a concept was kind of invented, I guess, through the rhetoric around the Brundtland Report about 30 years ago.
Which report?
The Brundtland Report. So which defined what sustainability is, you know, which is in effect not taking more than you should or can and leaving enough for future generations. When corporate sustainability, I guess, as a concept was sort of invented, we made it too simple, right? We made it too softly. So I think, and I certainly have been guilty of that myself in my own years as a practitioner around this, is that you are a bit of a cheerleader, I guess, in some organizations. You try and de-risk the concept that sustainability is an additional cost or a cherry on top that you can have when times are good, and you try and get people into the tent and say, you know, it's not going to hurt that much. you know, this is the right thing to do because it makes people feel good, and you're reasonably inoffensive around it. Mm. And actually what we should have done at the time is Adam's hypothesis is be more transparent about it and say, actually, you've got two choices here. In the context of planetary boundaries, we're using too much, we're consuming too much. Mm. And what corporate sustainability professionals should have done all along is to say, you've got a binary choice. Either you're in the tent and you recognize that it's going to take something of you in order to be sustainable, or you're not. And if you're not, then you follow the traditional market failure path and go out of business. And you don't sustain, right? If you are in the tent, then you're very clear what that will take, and you provide advice and support and guidance around what that will take. And we haven't done that. And I think the watershed moment for me in that report was really laying bare, which I've never seen done before, the number of companies that sign up to carbon zero goals or net zero goals or, you know, sustainable green outcomes, for instance, going up markedly over the last 30 years, and species extinction and planetary boundaries being breached, you know, equivalently or more, and just laying those out and saying, actually, you know, what we're doing here isn't working. Telling a good story or reporting against sustainability outcomes isn't actually having a positive impact or reducing a negative impact at the speed that we need it to.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is such a stark reality to see the conversations around climate feel like we've turned the corner, and maybe it's less about a debate of whether we should even recognize this aspect of our human behavior affecting the climate, to now, like, okay, we have a problem. I think a lot of the rhetoric has shifted there in, you know, call it the last 10 so odd years. But yeah, every line is going down and to the right or up and to the right that shouldn't be. Mm. And like, it is so sobering to see the habitat loss, the species extinction, the tipping points, the acidification, the pollution, the chemical, like it just, all of these different things are like, no, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And yet, you know, we have a culture of trying to, like you said, be inoffensive about it. You know, oh, we can be a little more sustainable or a little more green as a business.
Right. And that's seen as a softly, softly approach. And it's also inviting a lack of personal accountability a wee bit, I think, because, you know, the government will declare a climate emergency, or governments around the world declare a climate emergency. That's great. You know, we sign up to Paris targets, for instance, you know, that's great. But at the same time, you know, what does that mean to me? And I think it's probably been so diluted over the last decades that there's such a massive delta between the enormity of the issue and the size of the problem and what I can personally do about it, especially in New Zealand. You know, we have 84% renewables. It's not like in the States, there's a thing that you can do, which is put solar panels on your roof, right? And respond to it in that way. And in New Zealand, it's trickier. Yeah.
Although in New Zealand, our agriculture impacts are much higher per GDP, than in the States, for example.
Yeah. That's a complicated conversation. Yeah. Yeah. So I would go way further than sobering. You know, I think there's an enormous sense of regret in corporate sustainability in New Zealand at the moment for those of us that have worked in it for a long time, because it's kind of like, you know, we saw this train coming down the tracks and we knew this was going to happen, and now it's happening, right? The floods and the droughts and the wildfires are here and they're happening, and species extinction is happening, and it's, you know, this really kind of huge weight of regret that we didn't manage to avoid the train.
And it seems like, you know, when you framed it as this binary choice of being in the tent or not, but it does seem like the incentive structure has been misaligned. Like corporations and companies, you know, what we're really saying is like, do you want to continue growing and continue business as usual, maybe slightly greener, or do you want to somehow make sacrifices
100%.
And to potentially not grow and to make those trade-offs, but your competitors won't necessarily make those same trade-offs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Like you're still operating in a game where the incentives are for the externalizing the value of nature, essentially. And, you know, without those rules fundamentally changing, but we want you to somehow, you know, just be a better actor.
Correct. And again, that comes back to that, you know, because the rules tell me to, and because, you know, I only speak in economic value, right? And that is has prescience over absolutely everything, that we only speak in that value. And, you know, I had it explained to me really well by a Māori friend of mine recently, that, you know, he kind of smirked and said, you don't need to explain sustainability to Māori, because it is just the way that we see the world, that for those of us not from New Zealand, Māori are the indigenous people of New Zealand. So, you know, I live and exist in this place because my ancestors have given something of themselves for me. That doesn't necessarily mean a sacrifice. That means a conscious decision that I will live in a way that my future, that future generations can exist sustainably. And therefore, I will give something of myself in order for future generations to live sustainably. And it's not necessarily like a sacrificial debit, right? It's just a way of seeing the world that actually most other cultures see, not just not just that indigenous.
Yeah, example. I had a great conversation with Ayanna Young from For the Wild, and she reminded us that, you know, even the root of the word sacrifice is sacred.
Right.
You know, and just to, like,
a gift.
Seeing sacrifice as such a negative in our current lexicon and connotation. And yeah, just kind of a reframe around that.
Yeah.
So within the landscape of New Zealand, but then zooming out globally, like, what are some of the distinguishing characteristics of New Zealand in this region relative to what's happening globally around corporate sustainability?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think, you know, coming back to that, you know, reasonably negative example, I think the thing that is similar with the rest of the world is that, I guess, lack of personal agency that you take in the choices that you make, whether consciously or unconsciously, right? So a lot of the time you're unconsciously making purchasing decisions, for instance, that you aren't consciously thinking, I'm going to affect human rights risks in the supply chain, or I'm going to, you know, buy a piece of electronic equipment that has slavery in the mechanisms that went into it, for instance. At some point, there is a personal sense of accountability around the choices that you make, really, really consciously, and what's called the value action gap is pretty consistent around the world. So between kind of 20-25% of people. So in New Zealand, about 17% of people will actively make sustainably minded, conscious consuming decisions, and about 25% in the States on average. Everyone in the world says that sustainability is important to them, right? If you read any kind of, well, not everybody. So if you read any research, so the Kantar Global research will say that in India and America, it's around 80-85% of people who say that sustainability is one of the, you know, number one drivers in their life and decision making. But then only about 17-20% of people are actually making those decisions. So the
value is there. People are valuing sustainability, but the action is not.
That's the gap. So that's the value action gap. Yeah. And that's similar in New Zealand. And in the last few years, the thing that's coming through as number one in people's concerns, unsurprisingly, is cost of living, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's obviously connected, because if I've got a decreasing amount of funds that I can discretionarily spend, then I'm going to be conscious of the cost of living over sustainability-related choices, for instance. Mm. And that's connected in a whole lot of ways. That's the thing that's similar, I think, in the first instance. The thing that I'm finding probably most markedly different is one of my colleagues in the UK recently said that what they're seeing out of Europe and North America in terms of sustainability strategy, which I found really interesting, is that the leading practice in Europe and North America is that sustainability strategy is an organizational strategy. And I found that really profound. So you haven't got your organizational strategy and your operating context as a separate thing from your sustainability and climate change strategy. And that certainly is the case here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, at best, it's integrated within, you know, say your annual report in terms of the way that you report against it. At worst, they're just seen as completely different tracks.
Right. So we essentially have a business environment where we have the core operating businesses and their business models, and then we're kind of tacking on this corporate sustainability department.
Great. Yep.
And, you know, this department's doing its best to kind of continue to green, decarbonize, you know, reduce the impact, improve the operations while still maintaining the basic intact business model, structure, orientation, rules of the game.
Yeah.
And whereas overseas, you're pointing to maybe there's more businesses that are actually taking sustainability first as the core strategy.
Yeah.
And, you know, then obviously that's going to result in a more full scale set of changes than just
operationally and in an integrated manner. And I think in terms of insights, you know, the the biggest change that I've seen probably in the last 18 months, and this is due to many reasons, but probably most notably because of the change in a regulatory context here. So we, as a result of, I guess, trying to bring the integrated treatment of sustainability and climate change risk into an organisation, the global TCFD, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, has dealt with that. And New Zealand is the first country in the world to adopt that mandatorily. So from this year, New Zealand companies are mandated legally, 200 New Zealand companies are mandated legally to disclose their climate-related risks as part of their annual report. Mm-hmm. Which is huge. That's a globally significant move from New Zealand, and that's great. And the way that that shows up is that climate change has kind of been seen as this, you know, far in the future amorphous blob of risks that may or may not happen. And, you know, there'll be some sea level rise and we might get some roads washed out and we don't really know what that's going to look like. Mm-hmm. But what that's done is if you've got which every company should have, a risk register, and you've got, say, a dozen risks on your risk register that the board has to talk about every time they meet, and you drive your company according to those risks, that climate change is included as one of those risks, as a really, you know, serious risk to the business, and that you actually have to account for that. So that's really brought that conversation to the board table. So that's an example of top-down regulatory impact, I guess, actually changing the way that people are thinking here. Yep.
Right. So the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, TCFD. I mean, we're seeing this conversation globally, mm-hmm. right? This mm-hmm. this group has had a lot of impact on things related to climate accounting and climate finance. So what you're saying is New Zealand has adopted that framework and first in the world to mandate it for its businesses.
That's correct. Yeah. So I think the UK was first, but it's not mandatorily applied until 2025. It's this year in New Zealand. Yeah. So our version of that is administered by the External Reporting Board through the Financial Markets Authority. And there's been a change to our financial reporting laws in New Zealand, which means that we have climate standards, which are now mandatory in New Zealand. Yeah. And so that's what everyone's talking about now. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a way of getting people to think about climate change in a way that is real and present for them.
So if I'm one of those 200 businesses now, you mentioned climate has to be on the risk registry for the board conversation. Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through kind of practically what else changes or what else is new about these regulatory requirements as it affects those 200 businesses?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, you need to describe your transition plan. So from here to a 1.5 degree future, how you're going to transition from here to there in a really pragmatic way and make it clear to the people who are deciding whether or not to invest in your business that transition is going to be something that is sustainable and that they want to invest in. And that involves a degree of scenario analysis and figuring out what a warming world is going to look like and how it's going to impact your business. So it's, I think the mantle that I've sort of taken up around this as well is that one can get sucked into the rigmarole of reporting, you know, in a really kind of minutiae kind of pretty heavy way. And you know, I'm really keen to see people describe how they see the change affecting their business. So what are the decisions that you are making? So the point, the objective of any of this climate-related policy or regulatory environment mm-hmm. is to make you make better decisions in your business and to make investors and financiers feel reassured that their dollar is going to be safe with you because you're not going to go out of business in the next X many years because your business is fundamentally unsustainable. And that's a pretty profound change. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that really speaks to, in the States, a lot of the conversation around ESG and the investing landscape around environmental, social governance. How does that fit into the lexicon here in New Zealand?
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on ESG?
So many thoughts on ESG. I mean, so two things. One, I mean, I think absolutely it's been driven out of the States. And, you know, we talk about the Fink effect. So Larry Fink is the CEO of BlackRock, which is the biggest asset investment fund in the world, in 2018 kind of changed the without sounding, you know, too aggrandized about it, changed the course of history, I guess, because he said that he would require all of his investment funds to have ESG outcomes.
Sent a big public letter to all of the companies in the portfolio across BlackRock and said, you know, ESG now has to be part of our mantle moving forward.
And he calls it conscious capitalism, which I really love. And he's sort of taken the binaryism away from, you know, green investment being seen as altruistic or philanthropic to sensible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as he says, you know, he's not here to be a climate activist. He's here to make money. And that's mm-hmm. what is going to pay off in the long term, which I just think is just such a refreshing and constructive way of changing that conversation. Mm-hmm. And that annual letter that he sends his shareholders, you know, has been a consistent indication of the way that ESG is being managed throughout the world since then.
And to be fair, lots of criticism lobbied at BlackRock and mm-hmm. Larry Fink for not necessarily always walking the walk, or, I mean, bankrolling huge amounts of fossil fuel infrastructure still, mm-hmm. new oil and gas permits.
Yeah.
You know, and recently on Bloomberg saying he doesn't even use the term ESG anymore because it's become so politicized.
Yeah.
So some would say he's backing down or that he's folding to economic pressure. Yeah. How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I think every loaded term ends up being politicized, and do you pander to depoliticizing the terminology in order to keep on track, or do you, you know, it's a bit like feminism, you know, that is it helpful to keep using the term, or is it helpful to kind of keep doing the, right. making the changes, right? So, right. you know, every loaded term ends up being a distraction, and one wonders if that's just a political kind of rhetoric that's coming through to kind of slow it down, as it always is, generally, particularly in the media, which is super unhelpful. But in terms of how that shows up then, I think, you know, in terms of your question as to what ESG is, I mean, I think if you think, that's one of the trends that I've really noticed, I think globally and in New Zealand, is that confluence of environmental and social sustainability. And I'm really heartened to see the leaders globally and in New Zealand start talking about climate and nature as one thing, because if you look at the increasing extreme weather events as a result of climate change, the thing that is impacted more than anything is nature, right? So they cannot be disassociated from each other. And I think if you look at ESG as you know, a Venn diagram of intersectionality, if you think of the roles of, I guess, government and business and civil society within that, each of us do have a role within that, right? And it's not up to me as an individual in civil society to wait for business to do something or to wait for government. When I worked for government, if I had a dollar every time I heard the government should do something, you know,
sure.
everybody likes to say the government should do something. You know, at the end of the day, the government should do something, but their role is to respond to those and does respond to those communities and shareholders and to civil society in order to provide that regulatory context. Business responds to that regulatory context as it is doing now, but also to their community and the people that that rely on them or their customers. Mm-hmm. And then civil society also has a role in advocating for and demanding that change and responding to it. Outsourcing your accountability to government or business is unhelpful and isn't going to cause the change that we need quickly enough.
Mm-hmm. So you referenced the 1.5 degrees as kind of one of the guideposts for the climate reporting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to just make this link to the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you also referenced kind of climate and nature being, you know, kind of tightly interconnected, if not the same thing. And so, yeah, curious, like, your thoughts on the role of agreements like the Paris Agreement and how you've seen that kind of trickle through, and also what the agreement that took place in Montreal around kind of 30 by 30 and whether or not that's starting to have an impact in this corporate sustainability discussion.
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I guess starting with the Paris Agreement, the role of the COPs in general, I mean, how many have there been? 28 now, you know, that when you look at that number, you know, that's not a random number, that's 28 years. It's 28 years, pause for effect, of meetings. That's depressing. I think they send a global regulatory contextual message that is helpful to galvanize countries and industries and sectors and provide some clarity around a direction of travel. What is unhelpful, as you see on the ground with climate change happening, you know, for instance, in the floods on the East Coast that happened here recently, communities who are most vulnerable are impacted much, much more than those who are of a higher socioeconomic standing and therefore are able to do something about it and and respond in a different way. So mm-hmm. I think that's the, you know, the global just transition conversation is really similar at a local level as it is at a global level. Mm-hmm. My favorite quote from the last few years is the wonderful Sir Jonathan Porritt, who said, someone asked him, you know, why the failure of the COPs and why we haven't kind of dealt with climate change in 28 plus years. And he said, because targets have become a proxy for action and targets are not action. And I love that. I think he completely nailed it because, you know, many people, when you say, what are you doing about sustainability? What are you doing about climate change? We'll say, well, quote a target. I've done it. Mea culpa. You know, I've got a 30% carbon reduction target. Many people use that as unconsciously, hopefully, as a proxy for action, and it's not action. And not being cheeky, but I, you know, it's kind of my favorite question of people is like, and how is it showing up? Mm-hmm. What are you doing differently? What business decisions are you making differently as a result of that target? Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing. And I think people are definitely sniffing out that what's known as greenwashing risk. Shareholders particularly are, you know, really pushing the question on that target not being enough.
So, I mean, you have a first front row point of view onto your advising businesses around their climate behaviors, targets and actions. Like, what is the state of affairs? I mean, are we just greenwashing and kind of nibbling around at the edges? Are we making real change? Like, where, how do you feel?
Yes. I mean, it definitely catalyzes change, right? Because where you see leadership and signaling, I guess, then you have clarity around a policy response or a strategic response to that. Mm. Those companies who can change and more importantly use the opportunity as an economic advantage are the ones that are winning, as you well know. It has long been true that those companies who see climate change and sustainability as an innovation opportunity, because sustainability is innovation, right? Ecologically and financially and you know, human level, innovating is to sustain. That's why nature does it. That's why we should do it. Are doing better. They're more robust in the long term. Those that aren't are the ones that are, you know, clinging on to the Titanic as it's going down. So, you know, yes, change is happening. Where it is harder is in those hard to abate sectors. And that's certainly where the regulatory context gets really tricky, because those who are legislatively required to respond to these transitions and kind of can't without going out of business are going to definitely find it harder and do find it harder. Yep. Mm-hmm. But that's where the change is forced, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of those regulatory areas that's currently in public comment here in New Zealand is around biodiversity credits. Mm. And I know you spent a lot of time thinking about biodiversity at your time at Department of Conservation. Mm. Curious, like, what do you think about this conversation and the proposals that are being batted around introducing biodiversity credits?
Many things. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I have a philosophical challenge personally around perpetuating the conversation around valuing nature. And by valuing, we mean economically valuing rather than valuing intrinsically. And it's a really tricky one, because in every commercial context or development context, there is a deal that is done between a developer and nature. And there is a cost to that. There is a financial cost to that. Mm. What we are ignoring in that financial cost is the cost to biodiversity as a result of that. So, for instance, in New Zealand, the regulatory context that is the now defunct Resource Management Act, for instance, if there was a consent that was allowed as a result of a application from a developer to build a mine or a road or a wind farm or some big infrastructural project, a deal was done or an agreement and negotiation was had through that resource management context, and, you know, a number is arrived at. So what biodiversity offsetting does is figure out the true cost of what was then known as no net loss, but is now known as nature positive or a net positive result for nature as a result of that. Mm-hmm. What's really complicated about the New Zealand context is that we have such a massive amount of endemic species here. We have a massive amount of species. You look at a lot of other countries that have a regulatory context around that things are a bit simpler. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the likes of South America, it's so, so, so complex. I can't even begin to figure out how you would work out the value of nature in South America. But some countries have chosen to adopt a framework in terms of development that means that they can put a price on that nature that is lost as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Where it gets really tricky is that financial conversation between a loss of any biodiversity is worth X. And I'm not sure that we have really crossed that bridge effectively in New Zealand in order to be able to be having that conversation robustly enough yet.
Right. So an offset would be, an example would be, a housing development project is going into an area and maybe there's some, let's just use kiwi birds.
Correct. Yep.
You know, there, and the ecologist comes and says, this is going to kill 500 kiwi birds if we do this housing development. Mm-hmm. And so the effort underway around biodiversity offsets is to say, well, that developer should have to pay X dollars for that ramification in the ecosystem. Current state of affairs today, $0 being paid, right? I mean,
some dollars being paid, but not enough, and B, not ecologically, scientifically proven out in a way that is helpful. So that's what I was working on at the Department of Conservation, was working with a bunch of ecologists to work out what the price of a kiwi bird was, literally. You know, that was...
And what did you come up with?
I can't remember.
But it was a number.
There was no number for kiwi birds. Kiwi
birds are in danger. They're endangered species.
They have their own. They have their, but right. There was a number around oyster catchers here. Makes me feel kind of sick in hindsight. It's a conversation that is real and present and is happening. Yeah. And people have a massive emotion, including myself, have a massive emotional reaction to it because it's not right, but it is happening, right?
Well, it makes sense to me that you have kind of a legal framework at the base layer, which is like certain things are just not allowed.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's a different thing.
We're drawing the boundaries here around these endangered species, around this kind of impact on the waterways, et cetera, et cetera. And then above that, it's like, okay, we are a species on this planet having an impact on the habitat. We are needing places to build houses. Like, we are building roads. And like, so let's take responsibility for this and say, okay, these actions have an impact on the landscape. What are those actions? And what is our agreement and deal with nature?
Yeah.
Like, how do we listen to her and understand, like, okay, if I'm going to go in and put that sidewalk there, this is the ramifications. Mm. And we still think it's a good idea because it allows for pedestrian walkways and the cyclists to have a space. And like, we're deciding to do it, but what is that ramification? And in an economy that runs off of the language of money, why wouldn't money be present in that conversation where resources can be put into, okay, well, if we're going to do that, let's add new plantings to the side and add some more natural habitat where those birds can go, and to, you know, tend to the ecological corridor that connects these two spaces. And so to me, it's like a level-headed recognition of the situation that we're in and taking responsibility for our role in nature to say that the economy needs to include some of the, you know, needs to include recognition of the actions we're taking also through a financial lens, whilst having at that base layer a protection legal mechanisms that have a lot of no go.
Right.
You know, and that needs to be lifted from where we currently are, clearly.
Mm.
And we need to raise a lot more capital in this next layer. I don't know.
That's a really good summary. And one that is super uncomfortable for most people to have that conversation around is that, you know, we drive on roads and we use materials out of mining and we live in developments and therefore it's going to have an impact on biodiversity. But then you talk to anyone who says, you know, like, you know, it's zero, it should be zero, there should be conservation, right? So it's particularly in New Zealand, you know, we're so attached to our place and our...
But we're in fairy tale land if we don't think that all of these things are having an effect.
Yeah, it's a tricky conversation to have, And then the other thing from a market point of view is that it would need to be proven out that it actually works. And it's really complicated in New Zealand because so many endemic species in South America, are present in that particular place. So, for instance, you can't say, you know, I'm going to have an impact on this particular type of native skink in this place and I'm going to replace it with some native skinks over there because it's a different type of native skink.
Exactly.
200 meters to the left, you know? So, you'd need to prove out that it works. And there are some jurisdictions. So, Australian states have their own version of it. So they have what's called nature corridors. So they might build a dam or some sort of waterway and then have a koala corridor so that the koalas can still pass from one side of the forest to the other. Doesn't always work. South Africa have adopted it. France have adopted it. So there are places where it's been adopted, but it's much more developer driven than it is conservation driven. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the conversations I've had in this series around biodiversity credits as a general concept, you know, people keep pointing out, rightfully, I believe, that, you know, biodiversity is not fungible. So like you said, skinks over here, exactly. Skinks over there. Mm. It's like, they're not necessarily, every place is different, right? I think another common theme is that, you know, when we isolate these conservation conversations to specific species, we're kind of reducing a complexity that we don't even fully understand. And we certainly can't expect everyone to understand in all places and to then put this into a rule book that's going to actually do justice to the habitat that we're trying to protect.
Right.
Is a bit hubristic. It's a bit oversimplified. It's maybe well-intentioned, but like, you know, we can't even get carbon credits right.
That's
how are
exactly
we going to do biodiversity credits?
Where my head goes, right? Carbon is a homogenous product that can be traded around the world fungibly because it's one thing in the world, right? Nature is not homogenous anywhere,
right?
And that worries me deeply. So there's this new policy tool that's coming through really quickly called the TNFD, which is the Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which has kind of very deliberately named itself after the TCFD in order to get people thinking in the same way around incorporating non-financial disclosures into their financial reporting scheme. And I'm what's the word that isn't cynical? I'm skeptical around that, just for the reasons that you describe. Is that you know, the TCFD is as fast as it felt like it came on. It felt like it was here in like 2 seconds. Was 11 years in the making, 12 years in the making, right? TNFD and the nature related financial disclosures regime is coming through really quickly and will be adopted much more quickly than the climate-related disclosures, and is way harder, way, way harder. Like, I can't even begin to tell
harder,
you.
How do you mean harder?
In terms of valuing what nature is. Yeah, how do you work out the value of a kiwi versus a unnamed native bird in South America that I won't even try and guess at?
Right.
So there's that, and then there's the different regulatory context. So as we know, every country has its own version of their resource management framework, every state within that country, you know, so it's how does that treatment of nature sit within the existing regulatory framework that is already there in that country? And then how does that then fit within the framework of how companies react to it? And I think that's what I'm probably getting at with the, you know, don't just leave it to government, right? Mm. Like it's such a, it verges on a cop-out when you say, well, the government hasn't come up with its own kind of guidance and regulatory kind of framework for that. I'll do it when I have to. What you should be doing and what I would advise anyone to do now is figuring out what that impact is and figuring out what that value is. If you have an impact on nature in the first instance, start doing it now.
So how do you, because like if I'm building a shed next to a waterway, keeping this real simple for my farm mind
lived
here.
Experience. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I can spend an enormous amount of time and energy and money trying to find a specialist, trying to quantify, trying to create some sort of robust reporting.
Some sort of
before and after studies. Like I spend all of my budget on that, or I could spend my budget on, you know, a higher amount of labor costs to use less machinery or planting up the stream or like there's so many other ways where it's like, we kind of know what we should do.
That's exactly right. You know what you should do.
But it doesn't fit within the logic of then my climate financial reporting, you know, like I don't get credit for it in the external visible views. I have to just make that decision based on my own understanding of what that landscape needs and is best for it. And then I lose something over here. You know?
And that's a different thing, right? Because responding to climate related disclosures isn't doing sustainability.
Right.
It's a different thing. That's right. Responding to a regulatory legislative framework that you have to do because you are affected by it. Doing the right thing by nature and putting your shed in next to a waterway is a different thing. That is an outcome that you would have done anyway. So the thing that worries me as a ex-practitioner in the sustainability space is if you've got a pot of money to spend on sustainability or climate change and you're the sustainability manager in a corporate organization and you've got $300,000 to spend on sustainability this year, for the next 2, 3, 5 years in New Zealand, that's going to be on on measuring and reporting against your climate-related financial disclosures. Why would I then be looking at nature? Why would I then be looking at social impact? Why would I then be looking at modern slavery in my supply chain if that's the case? So that worries me a bit. And on top of that, you've got this resource constriction around, you know, the number one conversation I'm having in this in the corporate sustainability space at the moment is you can't get good people, right, and you can't get the people that you have got in the roles that they are performing functionally within the organization to do sustainability on top of the stuff that they're doing. Not because they don't want to and they don't get it, because they get it. They just don't have the time and the capability to do that.
Right.
So interestingly, I think we've got to the point, which is wonderful, where you've got the finance team doing the financial disclosures or the non-financial disclosures within the financial reporting. You've got the comms team doing the reporting within that. You've got the procurement team doing the sustainable procurement. Everybody's on the hook for their BAU to deliver against your strategic sustainability outcomes, and they don't know how. That is the biggest hurdle that we've got at the moment.
They don't know how because the structural changes required are so significant, or they don't know how because the domain expertise around supply chains and finance reporting and so forth.
There's a technical lag there, which, you know, I think it's super analogous to health and safety about 10 years ago, when health and safety went from like the health and safety manager's job to everybody's responsibility, right? And you know, it's a good kind of example in terms of there was a legislative change that caused that to happen. But now safety, everybody gets it. It's everybody's responsibility. It's just intrinsic now. Nobody kind of would argue that. It feels like the same thing's going on in sustainability at the moment, right? That people have got, like, it's gone from the sustainability manager's, you know, rah-rah, who's with me job to everybody's job. And there's going to be a bit of an awkward transition period, which is right where we're at the moment, until people kind of get what that means to them individually.
For those people who are listening, not from New Zealand, you know, New Zealand has a very strong health and safety culture that translates to the boardroom, and there's director liability that, is like severe for infractions or mismanagement. And so, you know, it is a culture where I've noticed very different than the United States, where health and safety is taken much more seriously here.
Is it?
And I mean, just...
And yet no free healthcare. Interesting.
Yeah. we'll go into diagnosing the policies around that in another conversation. But I guess, that is a hopeful frame and analogy that maybe sustainability is also going through its developmental stages, and it's going to become everyone's job and more of a cultural norm and more of something that all businesses have to think about across all teams and departments. And we just have a lag in some of the capabilities because, you know, the problems are coming at us really fast, and we have not done our work over the last generations.
So fast. Like, between one engagement and the next, the context is changing. But I think the hope that I've got in that is that, you know, when you think about that kind of trifecta of governance and business and civil society, that the regulatory context has forced that conversation to some extent. So with health and safety, is it, again, you know, that change in legislation meant that directors were individually and separately liable, personally liable to huge amounts of money for health and safety in the business. And that worked, right? It has worked here. This climate-related disclosures legislation does the same thing. So the board are liable for the climate outcomes of the entity that they sit on the board of. So interestingly, that comes through from the board level. Everyone's like, I don't know or care about sustainability. I don't even, you know, believe in climate change, but all of a sudden I'm personally on the hook for this. All of a sudden I'm sitting up and paying attention. So that's often where we get our engagements from at EY, is that the board are feeling the fear and coming and talking to us about what their compliance obligations are. And then that filters through, because then we get to open the door and say, well, it's great that you've got that compliance box ticked, for instance. But when you get to writing the stuff about the actions that you're taking to transition to a low carbon economy, what's under the hood there, right? Like, what are you actually doing about it? And then you get to come in, and I get to come in and write a sustainability strategy for you and an action plan.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I think it's an important lesson, personal accountability in the boardroom translating to real behavior change. And, you know, this is the G in governance, right? Yeah. Like, and so, I know that the social side is also really important to you. You mentioned modern slavery. You mentioned those who are most affected by climate change, often having, you know, less mobility in economically Tell me a bit more about how this intersects with the sustainability work.
In every way, right? And, from a local perspective of that is what's known as the just transition. So this sitting government is really focused on what's known as a just transition, or I guess an equitable transition between where we're at now to where we need to be. And if you've got a low carbon economy and you're looking down the barrel of, a higher carbon price flowing through to all of the decisions that you're making, therefore. So for instance, if you're living on the east coast of New Zealand, you're in a low socioeconomic community, you're miles away from anywhere. The price of carbon goes up, therefore the price of fuel goes up, therefore the price of your groceries go up, your cost of living is impacted. There's not a lot you can do about that. And, you can't put solar panels on your house and you can't afford to buy an EV. So it's accounting for those who are least able to respond effectively to the impacts of the economic tools that we use to deal with climate change and address just transition. And they're also the ones that are affected by floods and slips and loss of livelihood as a result of climate change. In terms of a global issue around social inequity, as we all know, it's the ones who are living in low-lying, poor communities that are super affected by, disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change. And that's certainly a live conversation that's had at the COPs every year. But I heard it described recently as a threat multiplier. So interestingly, and I'm going to quote this wrong, but basically I had it explained to me by a climate scientist that the war in Syria was a result of climate change because there were drought after drought after drought in the poor rural areas of northern Syria. And so the farmers moved into the city in order to get away from their drought-affected farms. And then there was this, a blowing up of religious and racial tensions as a result of that. So, and that's certainly what you see. So it's the unforeseen inequities in social impacts that that now the military are looking at as, a threat multiplier, which is fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, there's a tight correlation between food and energy prices and social unrest. There's been studies that correlate violence to rising temperatures and heat. And yeah, it seems kind of like common sense as our environment degrades, as access to basic, things that we need for our livelihoods suffer, then obviously other behaviors are going to come out. And this is going to have an impact on, how we think about defense and security and so forth.
Yeah, there was a really interesting case. There's a huge amount of, as you probably know, there's a huge amount of climate litigation going on in the world at the moment. It's doubled in the last 3 years, I think. So it's gone from about 800 cases 4 years to 2,100 cases in the last 4 years. So that's interesting. It kind of certainly sharpens companies' resolve or countries' resolve as well when they get sued. And it's working, right? Like it's getting attention and it's getting considered at a really high level. But there was an interesting case last week that was brought by a bunch of 2,500 Swiss women over the age of 64. I don't know what the relevance of over the age of 64 is, but which is not unusual in itself, and it's a class action, but it's been brought against the Swiss government for not doing enough to mitigate against climate change because of the heat waves that are going on in Switzerland. But they brought it to the European Court of Human Rights, which is different. So that's a big deal because that's the highest human rights court in the world. So that's a really big shift. Interesting. Watch the space. Yeah.
Well, it seems like, I mean, I think we're both feeling depressed about it all and hopeful at the same time.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, there's lots of glimmers of hope and reasons to think that change is afoot. And yeah, I mean, I'm curious, just kind of in closing out, like, how do we get more funding and capital into sustainable and regenerative activities on the ground, making a difference?
The government
whether
needs
it's
to do something
through business.
Yeah. How do we get more funding? I mean, I think the money is flowing, right? Like, it's interesting. Funding connotes government public funding, right? And I think the business case will prove itself out. What gives me hope? Two things. One, I have an interesting relationship with the term hope because I kind of feel like it lets you off the hook a bit, right? Like, I hope Larry Finkel sorted it all for us. I'm optimistic that Larry Finkel sorted it all for us. But, there's two things on that. One, there's a great piece of research that came out from NYU Stern recently around, they did 2,000 studies, which is a pretty inarguable number of analysis into companies that invested in ESG and whether they had positive or negative outcomes. And it was a resounding yes. So about 65% of companies who'd invested in ESG outcomes over traditional financial instruments had done better. 8% of them said that they'd taken a hit. So there's that, right? So the business case will prove itself. The government funding will flow where private equity funding goes. That's how the model works. I think businesses making good headroads into building sustainable businesses because they are economically sustainable. And as my friend James Shaw says, jobs happen on the planet, right? We can't, no planet, no jobs. And so people kind of get that. They get what their role is in that and their and they're future-proofing their business as a result of that. Not a funding answer at all, but the other thing that gives me hope without sounding completely trite is young people. So future leaders, I am lucky enough to have hired about 30 people into my team in the last 2 years, and all of them are extraordinary, extraordinary people that have, you know, double degrees with distinction, speak four languages, play sports at a national level, but more importantly, have set up not-for-profits and you know, really interesting social and climate-related movements in their spare time. And, you know, they're so earnest and they're so committed, and it's just extraordinary the amount of passion that they have for this area. And, you know, in the last 5 seconds, all of a sudden, you can study sustainability. You know, when I started out in this game, there was no way. I did my master's in international environmental law because it was the only kind of environmental or sustainability related thing in the UK because there were two places in the world that you could study sustainability at the time. Mm. Now I have three people in my team with a master's in climate change science and policy. You can study the SDGs. You can, you know, you can do a master's in sustainability in several places in New Zealand and many, many places in the world. So, you know, these young people that are coming through have the tools and the nous and the passion and the drive and the education and the capability to be able to apply to these extremely fast-changing times.
Yeah, wonderfully said. And yeah, reasons for hope for sure to see the next generation coming through. Any other final thoughts or closing comments, Jerry?
Yeah, I mean, my advice to businesses to, you know, as trite as it sounds, I think, you touched on it earlier, Matt, around the you know what the thing is, right? Like you listen to your gut and you know instinctively and intrinsically what the thing is that you can do. And particularly, you know, at a human level, you know what your impact is and you know the decisions that you need to make in order to address those. Listen to that instinct. It's right. At a business level, you know, I get asked this all the time. What's the thing that I can do? What's this, the first question that people ask me? What's the thing that I can do? What can my business do? And I just want to say to those people, you know what it is. You know, without sounding condescending, like, I think you know what it is because you know your business so much better than I do. You know your business better than anyone. I think you know. And it's just whether you can have that mindset shift and have that, you know, cause that intrinsic change to happen to do what it takes to allow for a more sustainable future.
I appreciate the thoughts and the conversation with you, Jerry. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jerry Ward. Firms like EY play such an important role in the evolution of our financial system and its relationship to climate and nature. You might also be interested in the discussion we had with Dean Spicer, Head of Sustainable Finance at ANZ Bank. You can find links in our show notes, as well as all of our conversations at maearth.com. We will be watching this space closely, especially as New Zealand finds its way to a more regenerative economy based on the well-being of people and planet. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.